I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. We all have a story to tell, and I believe by telling these stories, we can inspire and empower each other on our self-care journey. And Des Bishop does just that today. This season, I've teamed up with ReproMed, Ireland's leading fertility clinics. Having been through IVF myself, I understand how daunting a fertility journey can be. I'm proud to partner with ReproMed, whose world-class team offer the expertise, empathy, and compassionate care needed to help and support you. With clinics in Galway, Dublin, Cork, Drogheda, and Kilkenny, they are never too far away and will do everything possible to help you grow your family. Visit repromed.ie for more, and now their sister clinic, reproscan.ie, is available for early pregnancy and gender scanning. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning into the Good Glow podcast today. And I just know you are going to love my episode with Des today, and I can't wait to get stuck into it. Before I do, I just wanted to let you know that the Good Glow Live is heading back to the National Concert Hall on May 30th. We got absolutely incredible feedback after our last show in November, so we wanted to do it all over again. This is a completely new show with new content. And when I think of this show that we're putting together, I think of words like inspiration, enlightenment, fun, connection, lots of aha moments, and just a lot of laughs. I've been hearing from people who are bringing their mum for Mother's Day, people coming with their partners, the girls, and of course, lots of people are coming solo, and that can be a nerve-wracking thing. But I always say, you know, go to things by yourself if you feel drawn to them, because you could find your tribe there. So I've been writing back to lots of nervous people this week who were worried about coming by themselves. And I said, even though you will be arriving by yourself, you certainly won't feel alone. So that's May 30th. And if you want to get some tickets, you can head over to nch.ie. So on to Des now. His story is heartbreaking at times. I hung on every word he said. Des came to Ireland from New York when he was 14. He had a tough relationship with his mum, but so much love for her, and he really cared for her. Of course, life is full of ups and downs. Sometimes, as Brian Penny says, we're at 15,000 feet. Sometimes we're at 3,000 feet. But I hope in those dark moments that you always have hope that you can get back to 15,000 feet. I've been riding the wave in 2022. Lots of unexpected things have been happening to us. And it's taken me, if I'm honest, by complete surprise. You know, one minute I'm crying, brushing my teeth, and the next minute I am looking for the joy button and finding a little bit of light in every single day. So if you've sent me a message over the last couple of weeks, I just wanted to say a huge, huge thank you. They mean more to me than you'll ever know. So let's get into Des. I hope you love it. I can't wait for your feedback. Des Bishop, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
No, thanks. I was actually more paranoid about my skin coming onto the Good Glow. You know?
I called it glow because after my breast cancer diagnosis, and I went through chemotherapy for 5 months. And when you're going through chemo, you just feel dead inside. Yeah. And then when I came out the other side, people started to say, oh, you're glowing. So when I created my podcast, I was like, it has to stay. And I have to, that will motivate me to keep eating all the good stuff to remain glowing.
Yes. No, it can be quite the obsession. I actually never cared about skin. Actually, an ex of mine from a long time ago, she was obsessed with her skin, and she made me paranoid about skin. I never cared. And then suddenly I was like, oh my God, what's that? You
know? So do you do a little routine for yourself now, Des?
I really don't, actually. I just moisturize, but I just am aware of my skin more as a result. But no, I just moisturize, and I use crappy moisturizer. I don't spend any money on products, but so far I can't complain.
Yeah, you're just a natural beauty. Tell us about where you are now. You're in Ireland currently because you're on tour, right?
Yeah, I'm in the Barn. I'm in Dolphin's Barn right now, Dublin 8, where I live when I'm in Ireland. And I mean, I wasn't supposed to be gone for so long. I was only away because of the pandemic. So this is the first decent stretch I've had in Ireland since I left March 18th, 2020.
Wow. And I presume walking around Dublin 8, like you're a tall guy, you're pretty recognizable. Do you get heckled a lot on the street?
Well, honestly, around here, people are quite used to me at this stage. So you get it a bit. I mean, it's not obviously like things have calmed down quite a bit the last number of years. Like in the sort of noughties, it was pretty full on. But I know all the guys around here. I put my hood up a lot. I have the crack with them. So more often than not, it's just banter. I don't get heckled that much. Every now and then, like the other night, I was coming home late and I can't remember exactly why I was walking on the street as late as I was. But anyway, this like drunken guy was outside the chipper down the road from me and he was like, "Arno, he does want to start again. I got a selfie." And like he was very drunk and he was very like strong and he like was a lot shorter than me. So he had me like, he was trying to pull me down to get the selfie. But the problem was that like he like had me in a headlock, you know? And I'd say he's been to prison. This is not a judgment, but just I can tell that he's been to prison. And so I was like, I had to kind of like, you know, navigate the situation. I was like, "Yeah, nice one, yeah." And like he kept shouting at me. They all know where I live, so it's grand, but like he kept shouting at me as I was walking up the road and I was like, "Oh God, I can't wait for this interaction to end." But, you know, and he's a nice guy too, but obviously he's drunk. He doesn't realize how much he was manhandling me, you know?
And you spent the majority of COVID in New York, did you?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like a plan, you know, I just kind of left in a panic March 18th, 2020, because they were talking about like shutting down all flights to the States. And I like spending my summers in New York these days. And, you know, cause my brothers are there and I have that, we got this house, our family summer house. Like I have that now. And, so I kind of left in a panic, but I never like, I mean, I just kept delaying flights. I never would have thought that it would have been, it was a year and a half. It was I the first time I came back was August, 2021. So wow. It was a year and a half that I was gone. Yeah.
Whereabouts in New York did you grow up, Des?
Flushing, Queens. It's just like a semi-suburban neighborhood. And, you know, it's still a part of New York City, like as in it's in the city boundaries, but it wasn't very like, doesn't look like New York City as you would think of it. It's, I guess, I don't know how you would describe it. It's kind of like a upper working class at a lower middle class New York neighborhood, attached houses, but not like brownstones. A lot of people didn't have attached houses. They had like, you know, proper back gardens and everything. We had like an alley where everyone had a garage for their car. So it was just like semi-suburban New York, very normal, boring upbringing.
And you were obviously taken or shipped off to Ireland. I don't know how you would describe it. Sorry if that sounded insensitive to say you were shipped off, but
well, I actually, I mean, my joke is always that I got sent, but I asked to go. I put the idea into my parents' head, you know, because I had flunked out of school and there was other problems going on, booze related stuff and graffiti and just an adolescent angst. And my mother particularly, you know, she was a very anxious lady. Kind of like an over worrier. And, I had cousins that I had a cousin particularly that had gone very bad, like not that long before all this. And my mother just like, I don't know. She just like, whatever, in the anxiety world now, what would they say? She was catastrophizing. And she really didn't know what to do. Now, me personally, I had my own stresses with like, I was getting bullied and whatever. I was also up to no good, which was causing my own anxiety. So I had a lot of stresses that I didn't know back then. We didn't talk about anxiety. I was like very uneasy for a 14-year-old, you know? So my cousin was visiting from Waterford. She always did before she went off to work on her J1. And she put the idea in my head. I don't know why she was like, "You should go to boarding school in Ireland." And then she kind of called her parents and like they inquired about St. Peter's College in Wexford, you know, because that's where he went. My cousin's dad, which is my father's first cousin's husband. And so 6 weeks later, I was in Ireland. It was just kind of like this mad sequence of events. It wasn't like a life plan. Mm-hmm. My parents kind of laughed it off at first, but then it seemed quite easy. My dad loved it because my dad had the romantic notion about going back to Ireland. My dad was always kind of like very romantic about Ireland. You know, I think, you know, my dad had his own crazy childhood.
Did he grow up in Ireland? Or
so my dad grew up between Middleton, County Cork, and Sussex in England, but his English life was very horrible, and okay. his Irish life was fantastic. He was doted on by his uncles and his grandparents, so in his mind, Ireland was like Shangri-La. So I think in his mind, he thought, "Oh, Des going to Ireland wouldn't be a bad thing," which of course was totally fine, and. I think my mother was just like, it was quite cheap actually to go to boarding school in Ireland. In America, boarding school would be considered like very posh, but like St. Peter's in Wexford was not that expensive in comparative to like American cost of education. So anyway, 6 weeks later, I was in Ireland. This was not a life plan. It was nobody's plan until that sort of early July day when suddenly one suggestion kind of changed my life.
Wow. And you have spoken about your mum's anxiety and not knowing that was anxiety at the time. Where do you think her anxiety came from?
Her parents were bad alcoholics. You know, her dad was like a binger, but her mom was like a chronic, like very bad alcoholism. I found out like later in life, I guess, because she was a sober person in my lifetime. And, she was like the most amazing. My grandmother was like incredible to me, but actually my mother and her siblings had a very difficult childhood with the alcoholism. And it was funny because I found that out as the years went on, you know, it's like more and more was revealed. But I remember the time that it hit me the most, coincidentally enough, was my mother's brother was also in my lifetime. I was very aware of my uncle's alcoholism and then his sobriety, because there was a quite clear shift in who he was. He was this like scary guy, and then he was this like lovely guy. But sadly, he died young, 49, from lung cancer. He was a fireman. Years later, I was with my own friend and we bumped into his uncle, and his uncle grew up with my uncle, right? So we were talking about my uncle Kev, and this guy goes, "Oh yeah, you know, Kev was bad with the booze there for a long time. Like it was real touch and go. It was very worrying." I was like, "Yeah, yeah." But then, you know, he got sober in the end, and he was like, "Yeah, it was tough for him. You know, the childhood that he had, you know, was very difficult." And I was like, what do you mean?" And I was like, "Well, you know, the mother, you know, drunk all the time. And, you know, I think it was very embarrassing for them." And I didn't even know that it was like public knowledge, you know?
Oh my God.
Yeah, so they grew up with that. And a lot of, obviously, Irish people can identify with that. I think some, not all, but like some people will hear that and know about the shame, the stress, and the everything that comes with being a child of an alcoholic. But I never knew really. That was kind of the moment where I knew how serious it was for them, even though my mom and my mother's sisters particularly told me about it. Anyway, needless to say, they grew up with that chronic stress, you know? So I guess these days they talk about like PTSD. Everyone's got their different labels, but my mother was literally lived almost her entire life on edge. I think she never really recovered from the chaos of that, you know? And she had her own problems with booze. Before I was born, I never saw my mother drink, but she kind of gave up alcohol, but never really did any like work on it, you know, which is, it's not a criticism of my mother, but she was kind of left on her own. You know, it's a lot to deal with, you know, and then she had us. And it's just very hard not to end up passing on a lot of the shit that's going on for you. And unfortunately for my mother, and like obviously for us, you know, she was very difficult to be around. She was a very stressed out, chaotic person. So we grew up with like a lot of like stress and chaos that really was like unnecessary. And so that's what I talk about the anxiety. It's just that she didn't know. She wasn't like aware of it. You know, she literally was, you know, acting to her feelings, you know, this feeling that goes on with you when you have this chronic anxiety. So, I mean, she really did kind of like live a lot of her life feeling like sort of like everything was going to fall apart at any moment, you know? And she acted that way to very like non-stressful situations. She acted like the world was going to end if they weren't resolved immediately. And there's a lot of hindsight in me looking back. Of course, we didn't know that, you know, we just knew that we were like walking around on eggshells. Yeah. And it wasn't like a, I mean, obviously we were hit as kids, but honestly, the level that we were hit as children was very much in line with the level of hitting that you got in the early 1980s. I don't consider us really physically abused at all, but I have to say, you know, the emotion, the tension was torturous. And I, you know, you only become aware of that later on, you know. There's so many different levels of different times in my life where I discovered about that tension. But I think one of the biggest ones was my own friends started having kids. My brother had kids. And I just started to see the alternative. And I was just like, wow, it's very calm. It's very calm in these houses, you know?
And did that anxiety that your mom had affect her relationship with your dad? You know, you said that you were walking on eggshells a lot. Did you, and you speak about the tension, like, did that kind of really affect everyone in the house?
Yeah. You know, my dad's mom, I mean, it's really like, it's funny because my family's history is revealed to me slowly. So none of it seems that crazy, but actually when you put it all together, there's really like a lot of bad stuff happened to my parents and then their parents. So my dad's mother was actually paranoid schizophrenic. My dad was very badly abused by his mother, so much so that she was imprisoned for child cruelty. So that's official. I mean, I wrote a book about my dad and it's all in there, but my dad had a horrific childhood, like very, very bad, and ended up in foster care, and he survived all that. But, you know, so I guess my dad had a way of compartmentalizing things. My dad hid in the bottle for a long time too. To be honest, there's just alcoholism all throughout my family, both sides. So my dad stopped drinking, like, you know, in and around the time that I was born also, or had been trying for a long time, but got like recovery and like lived the recovery life for most of my lifetime. So yes, he was definitely affected by my mother, but there was probably a certain familiarity for him for the tension. And this is not to like, it's not to like villainize my mother and like give my dad a heroic story. He had his own issues and, you know, whatever, it's all very complicated. So I'll just say the facts. So for my dad, obviously when I got older, my dad would express to me some of the frustrations of living with my mother, but he was very dependent on my mother. My mother was very capable, you know, for all her stresses, like she really like got shit done. My dad was like very incapable. He was kind of like helpless. The joke I say in Mia Mama is it was very sad when my dad died. Obviously the grief was terrible, but very soon after he died, we realized like, wow, he did fuck all. like nothing changed. Nothing, everything ran the same. You know, the system didn't have to change. But anyway, it was difficult for him. She wasn't very affectionate. She was very cold. So later on in life, as my dad's relationship and I got closer and closer, he would express to me his frustrations with the coldness and the toughness and the, you know, the drama. But you know, they were together always. And, you know, I really kind of admire it in a way. You know, it is what it is, you know, for all my mother's flaws and my dad's flaws, you know, like the three of us, we ended up okay. You know, so it's very difficult because I these days I've done tons of therapy, got sober when I was 19, you know, I've never touched any non-prescribed mood altering substances. When I say non-prescribed, I mean painkillers from like surgery and stuff. I've never actually taken any like mental health drugs. That's not a slight on it, but I've never, you know, I've never like medicated for my feelings other than caffeine since 1995. And I've had my own journey with what they did to me. But overall, my feeling these days is like a lot of sympathy and actually kind of like, you know, impressed really in a way that they had to deal with what they dealt with. Mm-hmm. And everyone's journey is kind of cyclical. So obviously like myself and my brothers, honestly, I can't speak on their behalf, but I can say that like our experiences were very similar. We were all left with quite a similar sense that the eggshells and the stress was very difficult, like debilitating. And you know, I've done some therapy, and a therapist did tell me that, you know, like that type of like emotional abuse can actually be like a little bit more difficult to deal with because it's not as clear cut as physical abuse. And I'm just quoting what he said. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that people who are physically abused had an easier ride than me, not in any way, but, and I'm sure that with the physical abuse comes the emotional abuse anyway, but yeah, anyway, without, there's no point in getting caught up in that because people could misconstrue what I said. Needless to say, a therapist did tell me once that people do struggle with dealing with that kind of emotional torture at its peak.
Yeah, you know? I suppose because your mind can play tricks on you, or you wonder if you're imagining how you felt, or you know, that sort of way. I think with when something is emotional, you're like, did I imagine that, or did I actually feel like that, or did that actually happen in that way? I think it's hard for people to kind of navigate that.
Yeah, and honestly, as the years have gone on, I realized that like it's quite strange to go to another country at 14 on your own, and like I have to say that I now know that I was like dying to get out of there. Like,
Can you remember the flight, Des? Going, oh yeah, were you on your own?
Yeah, unaccompanied minor. You know, you get a little laminate.
Like a badge thing.
You get a laminate back in those days, a little plastic laminate.
So you went August, by yourself. How old were you?
14, yeah, August 25th, 1990. And whatever. Actually, I had a girlfriend then. We were together nearly a year. And my girlfriend and my parents, my two brothers, came to Kennedy and yeah, said goodbye. But honestly, you know, that wasn't like weird to me because it was very exciting, you know, and I was on the flight. I remember there was a couple from the north. I always remember they were like chatting to me, and I didn't sleep that flight. Every single flight since, because it's always an overnight flight to Ireland, mm-hmm. I've slept, but I did not sleep that first flight. And I remember this older couple chatting to me. I think they were like worried about me, you know? And then my cousins from Waterford met me at Shannon. I'd never met them. And
That's so huge that you made that trip by yourself. Can you remember any of the conversations in the airport, like saying goodbye to your family?
Nah, I can't really, honestly. I it was more exciting to me. So that that wasn't a particularly traumatic moment. I was just excited to go to Ireland. But it was mad. I cannot remember the emotions. I remember more just the hindsight of looking back and being like that was insane, you know? And also that I was like left to my own devices a lot because I mean, I was sneaky. I was not an innocent adolescent, you know? I was big into drinking and I liked the drama. You know, I escaped through drama, but pretty normal, you know, pretty normal adolescent stuff. And but I had the freedom because I was staying with my cousins in Waterford for the first 2 years and then friends of my godfather's for the final year in St. Peter's at the weekends, right? So I would be in boarding school Monday to Friday. Then I would stay with them at the weekends. But like sometimes I would just say to them, oh, I'm staying with my friend next weekend. But like I wouldn't even know which friend. And like I guess it was like a different time. Like, and they weren't my parents. So like they wouldn't like call those people's parents and be like, is it okay that he stays? There was just like a weird freedom. And particularly like when I was 16, 17, like I used to just like, you know, go off. And I remember just going out with this girl to Wexford when I was 17. And one time I ended up like staying in like an abandoned house. And I was literally walking around her area trying to like waiting for her to wake up because we didn't have cell phones or anything. You know what I mean? So I was like waiting for like a decent time to like knock on her door. And her mother saw me like walking around. And my girlfriend at the time said, my mom saw you this morning. Like, and she was asking me like, does he like have anybody looking after him? You know, like it was quite strange, you know, the freedom yeah. that I had, which I have to say I indulged in, but unfortunately that was the beginning of like booze coming back and causing me problems. So that was really the beginning of a bad 2 years of, you know, like the booze really caused me problems. So that's the thing, you know, because like my overriding memory of the first time I ever took a drink was relief. Like finally the stress. Like I literally remember thinking like, finally, like just relief from my brain. That is a very like vivid memory of just like, just relief, you know, which you're not supposed to feel.
Yeah.
Like I, like not to the extent that I did. It was very vivid, poignant moment. But the problem is that like, it's not a great solution to the problems of anxiety and stress and self-esteem and whatever the fuck else is going on. So, it didn't take very long for me. You know, I started drinking when I was 12. I stopped drinking when I was 19. It didn't take very long for the problems to kick in. They kicked in leading up to when I was 14, and then they took a back seat because actually I was quite into being in Ireland and I got really into school, and boarding school suited me. The routine suited me. So honestly, the novelty of being an American in Ireland, there was a lot of things that just really were good for me in Ireland. Like Ireland kind of saved me.
And were people like quite attracted to you because you were this, you know, person coming in from the States?
I mean, all I know is I had great friends from that time, and it was fun. It was exciting. And I was able to like, it really brought out the better parts of my personality. Like I really, I've always been quite extrovert, like into performing. And, you know, my first year in high school in the States, that was kind of quashed. I sort of fell afoul of a group of people, and I got a little, you know, I got a little bit of that isolation stuff, you know, classic teenage bullying stuff, which definitely was a huge knock to my confidence. And in Ireland, it was the opposite. I was really able to just like have fun. And honestly, you know, I don't really believe in segregated education, but like for me, like all boys school, like really worked for me, you know, just like one less distraction. I was very easily distracted, and the one less distraction definitely suited me. So all in all, my experience in an Irish boarding school, particularly those first 2 years before the kind of like the dark side of the booze reared its head again, those first 2 years were quite good for me, I have to say. So I can't remember how we got on that, but yeah, it was exciting. There was an excitement, and I think the guys in Wexford thought it was pretty cool that I was like this American guy, you know.
And when you say that you gave up alcohol when you were 19, like most 19-year-olds, you know, would barely know how to do anything for themselves, let alone go on a sober journey. So you were quite independent, I suppose, from a young age. You were probably older than your years. Have you never looked back from that point of giving up alcohol?
Well, you know, I was very, in those early years, I was very involved in like recovery and stuff from, you know, 17 was the first time I went to like a place where I said, I think I have a problem. And 19, I finally stopped. I mean, I have to say that my own parents, particularly my mother, because obviously my mother has always had negative relationships with alcohol. So she was from the age of 14 telling me that it wasn't going to work out for me. So I had a paranoia inflicted on me by my mother, which I'm very grateful for. So I was kind of conscious of the negative side, perhaps more than the average 17-year-old. But honestly, from 16 to 19, I had very few positive outcomes from alcohol. I had very big negative ones, bad incidents of blackouts, and just you know, I don't need to get into it, but needless to say, like very bad effects that you know, we're only going to get worse. And honestly, I was very lucky. I got away with a lot of like things where I should have experienced more trouble, you know, like in terms of like violence and stuff like that. So I was one of those Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde drinkers, which I'm kind of grateful for today, because I just, there was no illusions that it might get better. It literally was like every time bad stuff is happening. And like, for example, like I was 19, all my friends were 19. None of them were like, I think it's a bad idea for you to stop drinking. Like everybody was like, yeah, you're just like, it's not
for you.
Something's wrong, you know? So those early years, then I was just very involved in recovery. So just very quickly, it wasn't just not drinking, not using drugs. It was also like part of my identity. And it was actually the unifier between myself and like my new friends. I'm still actually very close with a lot of my friends from the drinking days, but in those first couple of years, I did take a break from those friends, and I did actually get closer to like recovery friends. And then, you know, obviously a lot of relationships from my friends when I was younger have returned over the years. And actually, funnily enough, the people I hang out with the most these days are actually my friends from before I stopped drinking. But I still have very close friendships with people from recovery, but not. I don't see them as much as I see the guys that I knew from before that. You know.
Mm. Where are you based in New York? Are you in Manhattan when you're there?
Well, I have an apartment in Manhattan, but I spent the pandemic out in the. You know, my parents bought a summer house in 1989. That was like in this area that was destroyed by beach erosion, and it was quite cheap, but it's a very nice area now. It was, they reclaimed the land and all this stuff. So it was a kind of a gamble that paid off for them. So very humble beach bungalow, but it's very nice to have these days. So myself and my brother Aiden have that. So I try to spend as much time over there as possible. It's been the main pull away from Ireland is that I have spent more of the summers there since my mom got started to like really have problems the end of 2014. So I did spend a lot more time in the States, particularly in the summer because of that house. That's really been the main reason, like no other reason. So I like to spend as much time there as possible. No matter what happens in our life, I will like to try to spend as much time there in the summer because it's pretty amazing. Like it's across the street from the ocean and it's pretty
wow.
nice.
And yeah. And your mom died in 2019, Des, is that right?
Yeah, March 19th.
Did she get softer in her older age?
Yeah, well, you know, my mom, I mean, she had gotten softer anyway, but like not that much softer. And we had this bonding experience, all of us, with my dad being sick, like he had lung cancer. And we had this like incredible year and a half journey of dealing with my dad. And, you know, I made a show and I get him on stage in Edinburgh and they came over. The whole family was together in Edinburgh for my dad getting on stage at the end of my show. It was quite an amazing experience that we had as a family. Like my dad's death is this oddly, like my dad getting sick is like terrible, but it's also like we have these great memories of this experience we had together as a family. So that was quite nice. That was like a very sort of like weirdly like special
healing
moment.
Kind of.
Yes. Unfortunately for my mother, you know, the grief obviously I think is tougher for the spouse. Like I it was tough to lose my dad, but like you always know you're going to lose your parents unless like something very bad happens. So I don't know. I just feel like the grief is tougher for the spouse. Like I felt for my mother, but unfortunately, you know, she was worse than she ever was after my dad died, which was understandable to a degree, but there did come a time where I actually kind of lost my patience with my mother after my dad. Eventually, after my dad died, I won't get into the details of it, but needless to say, I was making every effort to be there for her and for the family, and it was like a regressive feel. Just she was bringing her stuff to this, you know, despite all my efforts. It was like she was bringing all that stuff that she brings. And eventually I was just like, you know what? Like, I'm good. Like, I couldn't have done more for this family with our father dying and everything I've done for you. And I know that this grief is debilitating for you and I understand, but like, I can't. It's been too long. You know, like dad dying is very sad, but like this is decades of this shit and I'm done. So I stopped talking to her for a while. And I basically told her that like if she didn't get help for who she is as a person, like I just wasn't going to be involved in that stuff anymore. That's hard to say because it sounds kind of cold, but like it was too long. You know?
I don't think that's cold though, because you weren't saying I'm done, goodbye. You were saying go sort out your stuff and then come back to me. I think it's a really hard thing to do, but also I think a really compassionate thing to do, to say go get the help and come back to me.
Yeah. I mean, the truth of the story is that, you know, my dad died and, you know, we were very close, all of us. And, but you know, it's funny, before my dad died, there was this moment where my mother just said something like, it was before my dad died. She said something so exceptionally cold. And I'm not going to say what it was because there's other people involved. So it's their personal life, but needless to say, it was so cold about some people that should have been like her biggest concern, you know, because they were going to be the people that were around after my dad died. And I distinctly remember saying to her, "Mom, like, look what's going on here." I said, "You can't continue with this hate and coldness, because in the end, we are going to end up like not being around you. You're going to be alone. You can't be this way. It's too cold, you know?"
So you were able to say those things to her.
Well, because it was so bad. Wherever it comes from in her, whatever darkness was in her that felt that she needed to fucking lash out at anybody who she perceived as hurting her or even having the potential to hurt her. I can't really psychoanalyze my mother, honestly. Mm-hmm. I couldn't. But I remember that moment. I was like, "Ma, you can't be that way. You know, you can't dismiss the people in your life that you're supposed to be closest with like that. You're going to be so lonely, you know?" And what was even sadder for her was that she had nobody left. Like, she only had us, you know? She had, you know, like, I know she loved, but her love, unfortunately, her love was so skewed. It was so toxic that, like, you know, she had this, like, very, very small group. Anyway, needless to say, this moment happened. And to be honest, I'll tell you what actually happened, because, like, sometimes it can be hard to describe. There's so many little micro things. But the thing that actually put me over the edge was I wanted to spend the summer in New York, 2011, which was the summer after my dad died. And I wanted to just be there more, you know, for us as a family. And I was also writing this book about my dad. And I said, "Ma, I'd like to stay in the house in the Hamptons and write this book." And she was like, "Oh, but I was going to rent it, you know?" So I was like, "All right, well, don't worry. I'll rent it. I'll rent our house off of you so that you don't have financial stress." Because that was one of her, like, weapons was like financial guilt, right? I was literally paying her to not guilt trip me about being in the house. Like, I literally was buying peace. So I was back in July and I was like, "Ma, you know, I'm writing during the week. Come out at the week. Like, let's all be together as a family at the weekends, you know?" And, but even before this, she was, one day I was like, something about the house. And I was just like, "Ma, I'm fucking paying you to fucking be with us right after our dad died. Like, what is the matter with you? Our father just died. Like, wouldn't you want to be together as a family?" So then the whole time I was back there, everything like came back to like, what's wrong with Eileen? And I remember I was back here in this house in Rialto. It was like September. And I was thinking back to that time. And I was like, it hit me in September. I was like, you know what? Obviously, sometimes you question yourself and you're like, you know, is it me? But I was like, I couldn't have been more present. So I'm sorry that you lost your husband. I feel for you so deeply. Obviously, I have my own grief about losing my father, but I can't deal with this anymore. That was like the moment.
And did you even get the book written?
The book was written. Yeah. I got the fucking book written. Yeah. I got it written, but it was just the last straw.
I hope you are enjoying my podcast with Des. As you can probably tell, I am absolutely glued to every word he is saying. And I really believe that he is taking us on a journey in this podcast. And I just wanted to say a huge thank you to him for sharing his story with me. Before we get back to it, I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank ReproMed for supporting the Good Glow. A fertility journey is so personal, and ReproMed pride themselves in taking compassionate interest in your care. Having spent time with the team, I know they will provide you with everything you need to know about treatment options in a safe, supportive, and honest environment. ReproMed.ie is packed full of information on IVF, egg donation, fertility preservation, and so much more. So for more info, head over to ReproMed.ie.
So anyway, this all started with you asking me, was she cold or did she soften up? So in her defense, and it's very impressive at the end of her life. I didn't actually talk to her for a year. I got a lot of grief from her sisters, particularly later on about that. But it doesn't matter. This was actually between myself and my mom. She went to grief counseling, and actually originally she went to Al-Anon, an ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, to finally sort of like tackle her own demons from her own childhood. But actually, for some reason, she stopped drinking when I was born. She made a vow to the Blessed Mother that if she got pregnant, she would never drink again. And she never drank again. She got comfortable in AA. She actually kind of like found a home in AA, and she went to grief counseling, and it was the grief counseling.
This was after you told her, you gave her that ultimatum. She went and got help.
Yeah. But I don't take credit for that.
But you don't think that was the push.
It probably was, to be honest. So anyway, needless to say, a year, she came over to spread my dad's ashes, which was during that time that I wasn't talking to her, but we had a nice time as a family, but like, it wasn't like totally resolved, and I don't actually remember what happened with where the resolution came. But anyway, she really did like a lot of work on herself. And she was the one that came to me and just said, I didn't understand like the anxiety, we didn't talk about anxiety. She was actually the first one to talk about anxiety with me. I wasn't even like that acutely aware of anxiety back then. And this is like 2012, 2013. She got into AA and she started helping people, and she really she changed a lot.
Wow.
And like, honestly, I had many discussions with her from the age of 19 on about my own issues and like what I thought was tough growing up with her. And she, at different times, and she would kind of be like, I know you don't think I was a good mother, but so she kind of like would give that sort of passive aggressive kind of a thing. But after this time, when she did like some work on herself, she did have like a realization that it wasn't ideal. Which
That's
was
huge,
fine.
Especially she was a woman in her 70s, was she at this point?
Yeah, she was in the final lap. It was tough for her because she also had the grief to deal with, and she also had the empty nest and the loneliness, and she left herself very exposed. I was honest from my own side about what she did for me, but I have a lot of admiration and sympathy for how difficult it was for her, at that time. But she stepped up. I mean, she literally had like a good, she had a good final time of her life as a widow, sadly, because she was, she was like forced to like expand her circle and stuff like that. Like, it was all very positive. And it was very positive for us. We had a good relationship at the end, and honestly, we always had a very strong relationship in that she was always the dominant presence. I had a great relationship with my dad, but it was like less important because like all roads went through Eileen. My dad was like a auxiliary player in our house. So, I always had like a strong relationship with my mother, but like it wasn't like healthy or like enjoyable a lot of the time. But at the end, it was. And the sad part about it was that she didn't have that long in that final period of her life where she got a bit of relief.
Yeah, gave herself a break.
I mean, she lived her whole life with worry. Like, it's very sad, really, but she finally got a break from the fucking tension. And she was very open about how she had no idea. She was like clueless of the energy that she was giving off, because she really thought that like the world was going to fall apart if she didn't get done whatever she needed to get done. And she literally thought that every time we walked out the door that something horrific was going to happen. And like, obviously in our adolescence, when we started drinking, she like really was just reliving that trauma of her childhood, you know, like these circles, you know, these like cycles that you can't escape of, if I can just get my mom into bed or my dad out of the pub or whatever it is for them, that's their story to talk about. Cause I did not have that experience. Unfortunately, it felt very real to her. And I have to say, particularly since my mother died, I have a lot better understanding of anxiety and how potent it can be. I've had a few bouts now myself that maybe with a bit more awareness of what anxiety is, I can actually pinpoint it a bit more of like what's going on. It's quite debilitating. And like my mother lived with that debilitating anxiety with no help, no medication, no therapy for all of our life. And I honestly, posthumously, I have an even greater sympathy for my mother that like, it must have been torture. Like sometimes I think about when I have kids myself and how I felt since my mom died a couple of times, like just really intense anxiety that consciously, you know, is not based in reality, but it's just very hard to escape this feeling. It's debilitating. I know that my mother lived with that like all her life, and she raised us with it.
Yeah. But you know that there's, I can certainly relate to that because it's not that bad things happened to me, but my husband was diagnosed with MS. I got breast cancer. There was a period where there was a series of events that it just felt like one bad thing to the next thing. Yes. And my anxiety got so bad that Jamie kind of became my unofficial therapist. And night after night, it would be a new problem or a new worry or a new like off the wall catastrophe that I would create in my mind. And Jamie was like, one night he said, I can't be the person anymore. I cannot keep talking you down. I cannot keep doing this night after night after night. You have to get professional help. And I did, and I'm so grateful for it. But I can totally relate to that catastrophe, you know, feeling like you're a failure, feeling that if you walk outside your front door, that something terrible is going to happen. And I'd say lots of people listening to this podcast as well today could see a bit of themselves in Eileen.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I'm good today with the relationship that I had with my mother, which is like, it's always tough to have these conversations because you desperately don't want to feel like that people that think you're like shitting on your mother or even but also you do this like other people's thinking where you think, why does he think it was that bad? You know, like you question like, was it that bad? But I have to say that like these days with everything that we've been through and recovery, I was very lucky with the booze because alcoholism or my perception of alcohol, people change, but like the problems that I had with alcohol forced me to take a look at myself. And trust me, I found plenty of other ways to, you know, to try to deal with my shite that were just as unhealthy as alcohol, you know, food and exercise and bad relationships. But booze forced me to constantly say, you know, what's going on for you? And I've had varying level of success over the years, right? But these days, with all that work, I can honestly say that I don't know how my mother did it. I wish that myself and my brothers didn't have to bear the brunt of it, but it must have been torture to feel like all this was on your shoulders and you had this feeling. Now, I don't know about the physiological damage that can be done with that much stress all your life, but like my mother's body gave up pretty early, 78. She had any number of problems. I don't have the science, but I got to think that it was unhealthy to have that much cortisol and adrenaline. You know, that's the science part, right? Mm-hmm. She lived with those hormones running around at a level. I honestly, I don't know how she didn't go like really over the edge. I mean, she was pretty crazy at times. A lot of shouting and a lot of like, you know, a lot of hiding, but she was always able to get it done, whatever the, you know, she was always able to keep the ship going in her odd way. I don't know how she didn't have a breakdown that would require being committed with what she must have been dealing with.
And your life, like after Eileen, is it very different?
Well, it didn't help that pandemic happened. So it's hard to answer that because like literally within a year we were on lockdown. So I would say that the grief was terrible, but there was, you know, there was relief, I think, because my mother was sicker for longer than my dad. Not that long, but like long enough that it was close to like 5 years of worrying about my mom, for myself and my two brothers. Not worrying about the stuff we're talking about before, worrying about her health. And there was a lot of crisis trips back to the States, which began actually when I was in China. So my first emergency trip back to the States because of my mom's illnesses was actually when I was still in China. So there was a lot of back and forthing, a lot of stress, family stuff, and no criticism of her sisters. But I think everybody can identify with the family dynamics that can be just as difficult to deal with as the illness of the sick person. There was a lot of that. A lot of stress, a lot of like just illness related stress. So the sadness was accompanied by kind of like a relief of not having to worry about that anymore. But then the grief is its own journey, which was pretty strong. Like the anxiety, funnily enough, like the anxiety really started to kick off pretty early into like doing the Mia Mama stuff. And obviously every amateur psychologist will hear me talking about doing shows about my dad and my mother and their illnesses and deaths, probably consider that to be a little bit odd, but I have done that both times. And there was a lot of anxiety, particularly with the show, with my mother. When I say anxiety, I don't mean about the show. I actually just mean like I had some real feelings of anxiety mixed with the grief and, you know, a lot of like intense emotions that I can't really put my finger on. They were just there. The one bonus about the pandemic was that I was forced to just like be with myself, which was a help, honestly. But really, it didn't kick off until, you know, I met Hannah and had this intense emotional connection with Hannah very, very quickly, which wasn't helped by the fact that she then had to disappear for 7.5 weeks because she was filming this thing. But we literally just met before she went in to film this thing. So funnily enough, the intense connection that I had with Hannah really kicked off some like intense. First it was the grief for my mother. And then actually I got a lot of sadness for just like my own wreckage of like past relationships that like definitely were affected by my own dysfunction. And, you know, like just times myself where like, I think I, you know, ran from closeness, you know, my own fears, you know, times where I balked would be the word that I would use, you know, times where, you know, like I couldn't be there emotionally. I just suddenly like it all just hit me one big boom of grief, which actually the grief was a relief. And then there was like a sadness, a guilt, you know, for the wreckage of my own past. And then, you know, that was kind of like a relief for that too, you know?
And what made Hannah different?
It's just timing, you know? I really feel like a lot of it is just timing. Like I was ready then, you know? Like there was a pandemic.
And she's the one.
but that's a whole separate podcast because she's the one. It's just bullshit, right? Hannah is amazing. We're so deeply in love with each other. And like, it was just clear that she, you know, she was like somebody that I could spend. But the whole, like, she's the one thing, because I believe that life is random, you know? And I was just very lucky that we connected at that time, you know? And, you know, but I do think that a lot of it was timing. And it was a great time, I think, for both of us, actually.
Yeah, it does seem like it was really good timing for you. Now that you say it, it makes so much sense that this relationship happened for you at that point.
And obviously, there's two ways you can look at it. I think life is kind of random. Other people will think that she's the one, and it's providence. And when I say she's the, like, of course she's the one, you know.
Yeah.
But when I resist that, by the way, I resist it on the point of like, I don't believe in destiny or anything like that. But I do believe that we met at the right time, and it was a great bond, you know. But I do think that, like, you know, life is pretty random. But I'm very happy that I met her at that time. Very immediately, it had huge, like, I hadn't felt that. If you actually go back and listen to my podcast at that time, I mean, I was deeply, deeply infatuated. And like, it was like almost too much. Like, I almost couldn't handle it. You know, Joanne McNally was doing my podcast back then every week. And she was like, oh, I have a pain in my hell with listening to you going on about fucking Hannah and like fucking get over yourself. It was pretty intense, actually, the infatuation phase for us. But I was grateful to have it. I hadn't felt that in a very long time, you know, like it had been quite a long time since I felt that.
Was it nice level. Actually that when you met each other, then you had that time away? So it like,
I mean, I would have preferred not having that, honestly, because actually it left me a little bit like, you know, it was a bit much. I would have preferred a more natural beginning than that, but it was fun because the intensity of it was pretty fun. But honestly, the intensity of it and the anxiety that rose up in me from like whatever kicked off in me after meeting her. I mean, it's no surprise that like when suddenly I felt vulnerable and felt connected to somebody else, that like something, honestly, I had like such intense anxiety, and it was a very intense time, so much so that I actually got a therapist. I talked to a therapist for the first time actually in quite a number of years to sort of make sense of like the intensity of emotion that I was feeling. Cause obviously I had a lot going on. It had only been a year and a half since my mom died. Also had an enforced isolation, solitude. So, you know, you're just very open to your feelings, you know, and I'm not like the most normal guy. I had a lot of yeah. stuff. So it was pretty big, I have to say, which was great. I got a bit of therapy.
So are you saying you got the therapy when you had these feelings of love, basically?
Well, the love, but then after the love came like debilitating anxiety also.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Like it was too much. I couldn't sleep. And you know, if you look up like infatuation or like the hormones of love, it's all there. Like it actually, it's very clear in writing that sometimes it can almost be too much. You can't sleep. Mm. You're secreting all these hormones. But obviously it was also triggering off a lot of grief stuff and past, you know, just like, just a lot of feelings were going on.
I really admire you for returning to therapy or like keeping it in your life, because I think for so many people, they do therapy and they're like, okay, I've done it. Why would I go back? But you know, you keeping that in your life, I think, is really admirable.
But it was very good too, because so this particular therapist really dealt with it from the point of view of anxiety. Like she really. Because I've done a lot of therapy, like looking back and, you know, trauma, you know, like kind of like trying to heal the wounds of the past. I've done a lot of that and it's been great. But she, for the first time, was very into, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and sort of looking at, you know, fact and opinion. You know, this kind of like, she liked to look at like, what's a fact and what's your opinion? Like, in other words, like what's real and what's like in your stinking thinking, your fucking crazy brain. And that practical, that was very good actually from a practical point of view to just like counteract. Cause she said basically like, this, you know, a little anxiety moment here triggered by numerous things that are going on. But like this will come back like this, you know, you have the way that you're wired, like there will be times where you will be overwhelmed by stuff and you have to be quite vigilant. So as much as it's great to go back and heal, it's also good to have these tools for keeping your thinking from not taking over. This was like kind of the stuff she was saying. And so I was happy to get those practical tips on sort of like what is real and what is in the anxiety brain, catastrophizing, running away with yourself. I did that with her. Now, I have to say, I have to rat myself out. I haven't been great at keeping up those like little worksheets she gave me. I mean, it was virtual anyway, but I haven't been great at keeping it up. And there are times definitely where I feel like it would be a good idea to do that. But yeah, that gave me a little. And it's funny, she was less interested in the grief. She was actually like, I think you have a good handle on, you know, what went down between yourself and your mother. But, you know, I think you need to really get into the practical ways of dealing with, you know, anxiety, you know, because I mean, in her opinion, and I actually haven't looked this up, but she thinks there's a little bit of genetics involved that like, you know, some people are more prone to it. So she was like, you're probably somebody that's going to be prone to this. So these are some good tools to have.
And what's in your toolbox, Des, in terms of like, for me, it's cold showers or getting into the sea. I find just really helps me get a handle on myself.
Yeah. Well, I've always been a sea guy. Meditation at times, but you know, with meditation for me, I feel like at times when I let it slip, the problem is that like, I feel those things work best when you do it on the regular. So a meditation that came from years, like that actually came from early recovery, like early sobriety, being clean, all that stuff came. I like writing stuff down. It's actually funny enough, doing a little cleanup recently. I always find my old diaries, like, you know, my old, like the first five pages, and then, you know, like I lose it and then I'll find it like, you know, September 7th, 2006, I'm on the beach in Australia, you know, like with my self-obsession.
when you say write things down, are you writing down like sentences or words or how do you do it?
I'm into like journaling. I would say journaling is probably the modern, since everything is very, everyone, you know, I always joke with the early recovery guys because we were like the only people fucking looking after ourselves back in those days, you know.
Yeah.
Now everybody's into it, you know. So now everyone's got the terms. So I would say like journaling and exercise. But unfortunately, I've had so many bad injuries. I'm actually about to get surgery on March 22nd. So I lost actually like regular exercise, which was quite a loss. And I'm not great at doing. I don't get as much out of the type of exercise that would be good for me now, like the strengthening stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as much of a release for me.
And Des, I just don't want to be insensitive by asking this question, so you may not be comfortable with it, but would you be confident to say that you've broken the cycle of your parents and what they went through and your grandparents and what they went through?
I really don't know. I'd like to think so, but then you really just don't know. And like, obviously watching my friends raise their children, I think that every generation is going to find problems. I'd like to think so, but I just don't know.
Do you think about that?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I look at my brother. The realest example I have is my brother raising his kids, and it looks to me like a hell of a lot nicer. And those kids, I don't know. I'd like to think. And listen, my nephew gets in trouble at school. He's not unlike us, you know. He's a little demon and all that. But I would hate that to totally disappear. I feel like that's just in our DNA.
You need a bit of that, don't you?
Yeah, I feel like that's in us, you know, part of our personality. But I'd like to think so. But I really, honestly, I don't know. But I would hope that the awareness, you can't take away that. You can't take away the knowledge that you have. And I would like to think that if I was raising kids and the stress was getting the better of me and I could see that it was getting passed on. I'd like to think that I would check myself. I'd like to think that at least that cycle has changed. And listen, if you see the Mia Mama, my dad's mom was paranoid schizophrenic. I mean, there's a lot there. So I'd like to think that if my kids end up presenting me because I'm a little bit less stressed out than my mother was, that'd be a decent journey from suicide and prison and whatever the fuck else is going on. You just never know, do you, right? Because you could be in Ukraine. Like, here we are talking about all this stuff. And I'm not trying to broaden into international issues, but like, for all the stuff that we're talking about, like, there's just so many external factors that you can't factor in that aren't fair. So I think everybody will have their challenges, and every generation deals with it differently anyway. So we'll see, you know?
Well, Des, thank you so much. Best of luck with the rest of the tour. Best of luck with the summer. Are you going to New York for the summer this year?
Yeah. I'm getting married May 13th. So, I'll be back there for that. And then we'll see. You know, we'll see what happens for the summer. Actually, not 100% sure.
Best of luck with the wedding. Enjoy every minute of it. And thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Good Glow podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe, because that makes such a difference. We will have conversations like this and so much more at the Good Glow Live in the National Concert Hall on May 30th. We're going to have singing, dancing, fun, aha moments, inspiration, enlightenment, you name it. So if you'd like to join us, head over to nch.ie for tickets.